My name is Stephen Slaughter, and this is the Envisioning Education Podcast. I'm a teacher who has decided I need to step back and ask some fundamental questions. How should we be educating children today? In what ways has school evolved or not since the industrial age model was implemented? What does true learning look like for humans? In a world of rapidly changing technology, what are the core skills young people will need as they enter and begin to navigate adulthood? Spoiler, I don't think it's all about learning tech skills. COVID brought enormous disruptions and trauma to schooling globally. It showed us the usefulness and limits of doing screen-based school. And even in places where class is back in person, the effects are not over. Ask any teacher. I've heard some say that in some ways this year is harder than last, and last year was really hard. But if we're reflective and brave, we'll also see that this crisis has given us the opportunity to reconsider what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how we might re-envision education moving forward. COVID has flipped on a glaring light, revealing many of the entrenched weaknesses in the current systems. Will we use this moment to help us serve children better? First, a few minutes about me, the backstory. After graduating college in 1990, I spent a dozen years in visual design, creating logos, brochures, ads, and other print materials, morphing into digital and web design by 2000. I began to feel restless in this work. While I still enjoyed the creative challenge, I wondered if something else might be more fulfilling. When my daughter began elementary school, I volunteered in the seventh grade tech class, helping the kids work on the school's website. A pattern emerged. When the period-ending bell sounded and the kids went on to their next class, I walked down that noisy hallway, depressed that I had to return to the world of adults. If only I could spend my time with kids all day, every day, I thought. I'd been looking for a sign of what should be next for me, and this seemed like that sign. With the help of the Golden Apple Foundation, partnered with the Northwestern University Ed Grad School, I completed a fast-track career changers program to become a teacher. That fall, I got my first job in a Chicago public elementary school and spent 8 years teaching grades 1 and 5, finishing my master's degree and gaining national board certification along the way. I love teaching, and though high-achieving and well-supported by parents with a great administration and staff, it was still a CPS neighborhood school and faced the same crushing class sizes and mountains of bureaucratic nonsense of any big city public school. When I taught grade 1, I had 37 students the first year and 38 the next. 37 6 and 7-year-olds. Let that sink in for a minute. Any parent who has tried to put their mittens and coats and hats on a couple of kids, just imagine what it takes to do 37. On my afternoon bus ride home, I would often crack open my novel to read something other than picture books and promptly fall asleep, sometimes waking up disoriented a mile past my stop. Still, I loved it. I loved my school, the way we struggled through the many dubious mandates sent from downtown to give our kids the best school experience we could provide. Mostly, I loved working with my students, spending my days with them. I still do. Then in 2012, an opportunity unexpectedly dropped into our laps. Some friends had moved to Nairobi, Kenya to teach at an international school, which happened to have an opening for a middle school English teacher, my favorite subject. For years, my wife had dreamed of moving to Africa one day, and this seemed like the fulfillment of that dream. So I quit my job. We sold or gave away or stored all of our stuff, rented out our house, carefully stuffed our remaining possessions into 21 plastic bins, and left with our 3 kids in tow. They had just finished grades 3, 5, and 8. We loved our new school and our life in Kenya. We lived right on campus and enjoyed a lovely community there. As a private school, we did not have the mountains of absurdity so many public schools must endure, and I had an administration that trusted teachers and didn't micromanage. Every year, the school's diverse student body represented over 50 countries, which made the cultural and learning spaces endlessly rich and interesting. I got back into theater, a love of mine from high school, working on loads of plays, and eventually shifted from middle to high school English. We stayed longer than expected, 9 years. Until our youngest just graduated from high school. We moved back for family reasons. It's hard being away for so long. But we and our kids loved expat life, and each of us would probably move back abroad again one day if given the chance. Our kids have each taken gap years and think of themselves as world citizens as much as they are Americans. Transitioning back to the U.S. is disorienting for most folks, ourselves included, and moving back into our old house on Chicago's north side, it's been a little surreal, sort of time warp. Which brings us to the present. In the year leading up to our move back, a year framed by the chaos of COVID, I contemplated what sort of school I would want to work in next. I had always had a creative, somewhat unconventional approach to teaching, and while kids and parents usually appreciated this, it inevitably also was a challenge operating within conventional school models. With so much structure, fixed curriculum, and a traditional school philosophy, not to mention standardized testing, a number of my ideas created some complications, more on that in later episodes. So I wondered what sort of less conventional or progressive schools were out there. Beyond a rudimentary understanding of Montessori and Waldorf, I was not very knowledgeable about such things. My research has led me to a place I didn't even really know existed, the world of self-directed education. I knew about homeschoolers, of course. Most of those that I knew followed a fixed curriculum similar to regular school. Then there were the tiny subset called unschoolers, who have no curriculum and follow their curiosity, learn the things that interest them. Eventually, I discovered that a few schools and learning centers had been established, gathering these unschoolers together, gaining the social aspects of schooling so important to kids while maintaining the freewheeling DIY approach to learning. This kind of blew my mind. As an Enneagram 5, my research kicked into high gear. I joined a six-month course called Another Way for folks exactly like me wanting to learn all we could about this weird new world. I watched the lectures online and read books and articles, listened to wonderful interviews and podcasts like Blake Bowles' terrific off-trail learning. And I did a summer training for facilitators at Agile Learning Centers, one of the new wave of self-directed learning networks popping up around the world. Due to living overseas and COVID, one missing piece for me was actually seeing this in action, visiting and interacting with actual kids doing school or unschool this way. I had done all of the interaction with adults. I'd read the theory, but seeing it in person was key. So this fall, I converted my Subaru into a car camper, and I set off for the East Coast to visit some of these places firsthand. And I decided to start this podcast because I wanted to document and share the voices and experiences of these kids. If, like me, this is new to you, there's a lot out there to read, watch, and listen to, and I'll share lots of resources with you. But there hasn't been much from the kids themselves. So I wanted to add that to the mix. On this initial trip, I was able to speak with several different groups of kids. A family looking to relocate to be close to one of the centers. A group of kids going out into New York City to explore. A guy planning to open his own center. And others. I'll confess right up front, I'm still not so sure exactly where I land on all of this. And another reason I'm doing this podcast is to help me sort out what I really believe is best for kids. You'll probably disagree with some of what you hear from me and my guests, which is fine. I do too at times. I'm currently pretty far down the road to believing that giving kids more autonomy is a good thing. So if you aren't there yet, some of this will feel pretty strange or even threatening. It's okay. It felt that way for me too. And frankly, I don't buy in yet to the complete lack of structure by design of some of these alternative learning models. But what I do believe is that the current systems are not working very well for many kids, and even for kids who are able to navigate it successfully, I'm troubled by much of what learning really means day to day in conventional schools. Just ask a kid 2 weeks after they complete a big exam how they would do if they retook it today, and they will laugh. I've done this on several occasions, and they always laugh. I would fail, they say. If temporarily cramming content into flash memory for assessment makes up most of how we define learning, we might really need to rethink that. This podcast is about joining me on this journey as I try to figure out what to do next. Do I open my own self-directed learning center? If so, what will it look like and what principles will it be built on? These are big questions for myself personally and maybe also for others who are ready to consider new approaches. And I'd love for you to join me in figuring it out. I'm not exactly sure how to order these first few episodes. Since my focus is self-directed education centers, should I begin with one of my interviews with kids? That would make sense. Or should I allow things to be a bit more organic, following the path of my travels? This whole journey I find myself on is very much an exercise in SDE on my part. And like Frodo dashing out the door to catch up to the dwarves, something tells me to just tell the story as it goes. Leaving Chicago, I headed east, stopping to visit an old friend in Cleveland, and then heading out for Ithaca, New York, where I had arranged to meet Rusty Keeler. I had been an admirer of Rusty's for some months, since stumbling upon him on YouTube. Rusty is a designer of adventure playgrounds, sometimes called junk playgrounds. If you have never seen one of these places, look it up, or better yet, go visit one. We met up at the Ithaca Children's Garden on a beautiful summer day at an area Rusty designed called the Anarchy Zone. As I was getting out my recording gear, excited for my first interview, Rusty rolled up on his extra-long e-utility bike with a huge seat on the back to haul a couple kids around. He handed me a copy of his book, Adventures in Risky Play. Reading it inspires me to build one of these places here in Chicago. I recommend it. We sat down on a bench to talk, watching a group of kids playing in the Anarchy Zone. All right, Rusty, I am so glad to meet you. In person, I've been a fan online for a while. Checking out your backyard videos, giving us the tours of those, and seeing your son clamoring around all the time as you're patiently trying to focus on the camera. It couldn't be a better day. We're here at the Ithaca Children's Garden at the Anarchy Zone. Can you give us a little, just sort of a snapshot walk through your life? I don't think there's that many people that do, at least maybe your professional life. Like, you've got a job that's kind of unique and that most people don't do. So tell us a little bit about that to start.
Sure. So I guess I would call myself a natural playscape designer. And playscape, the idea of like creating landscape for play. So it's a little different than a playground, although I started off doing playgrounds. I started off as an industrial designer, and my first job out of school was designing playground equipment. And that's where I kind of learned about play, kind of the deep aspect of play, more than just running around blowing off steam, but also all the different kinds of development, social development, intellectual, emotional, and physical.
Was that learning part of like the program itself, or that you were taking with industrial design, or is that something you kind of picked up along the way separately?
That was with my first job. So at school I studied, you know, I don't know, I thought I was going to like design boom boxes or lamps or cars or something. But it was the first job out of school was with a playground company, and they had just got bought out by a big Danish company, Compan. And they wanted to do a whole new line of equipment and wanted to be based pretty purely on children's play. You know, I always kind of looked to Denmark for really, you know, honoring and respecting children and play and their needs and providing for that. So it was pretty neat to be in this small American company then that suddenly had this kind of the Danish philosophy. And that's kind of where I studied it as in progress as we designed things. And then we had a link to Dr. Joe Frost down in Austin, Texas, who taught play and child development, inspired a lot of people. So we were kind of doing prototypes with him and learning along the way. So I started doing the kind of the traditional, you know, more jungle gym kinds of things, post and platform playgrounds. But then my ideas kind of shifted more to this natural play and connecting kids to nature through play. And so the playscape, instead of it looking like a jungle gym, looks more like, I don't know, it could be a vacant lot, or it could be a park or a mini park with hills and pathways and sound elements, or sand and water, mud, plants, trees, kind of connecting kids to just the outside world and where they live and the seasons.
So why don't we, so we're sitting right here at the Anarchy Zone. Why don't you just, can you describe some of the components of it? For those who don't know what this sort of play space is like compared to it, because most of us think of a park as a playground equipment, a jungle gym.
Yeah.
Like, what are we seeing right now?
Right. So, you know, so the rest of the children's garden is kind of nice. There's a manicured lawn here, and there's some vegetable gardens and, you know, nice flowers and things. And then the anarchy zone is this mix of nature and junk. Right? So there's some beautiful trees, and so kids can climb trees. But then there, I see a tire on a branch in a tree. There's picnic tables for adults to sit on. But then there are all these, like, giant plastic, looks like leftover underground tubing that, you know, that contractors use. And so that's everywhere. There's tractor tires. There's boards. There's chunks of trees. There's stumps that kids can roll around. There's rope. There's, you know, just kind of all sorts of loose parts. So there's like a landscape with hills and plants and all that. And then there's just like loose parts galore for children to play with and create their own spaces and play elements.
So in your observation, I guess, or not more for you, it's more than observation. Like, how do children engage with a space like this differently than they do? Why not just build playground equipment?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Presumably, it would be safer. I mean, at least, like, you would assume that. I guess as adults, we think that things that are designed carefully are safer than tires and junk pieces and stuff. Like, how does but we'll get to the safety aspect later, since that's definitely got to. I'm sure it comes up all the time with your work.
Sure.
But just, like, how do kids engage with it in your observation and engagement with them?
Yeah. You know, there's something about the hands-on nature anarchy zone here. When you first see it, and when kids first see it, it's obvious that this is a kid's place. Like, adults did not do this stuff, this crazy stuff that's all piled up, built, and, you know. So it looks a little wacky, and it looks a little beat up, and those things are almost the cues for children. Like, they know, oh, okay, this is, and the name, I guess, the Anarchy Zone. Like, this is a place that I can do stuff. Other kids have done stuff here. And, you know, one thing I like about it is that every time you go by here, it looks different, you know, depending on who was here, what their ideas were, you know, what the loot, the stuff was that just got delivered or dumped. And, yeah, so I think once kids realize that they can do stuff, because still maybe kids, they're not used to just having total freedom or be able to just play, or they might look to the adults like, is it really okay for me to do this kind of stuff? But once they realize that and they know that they can, then it really is freedom to just mess around. Yeah. Dig in the dirt, you know, see what's under there. Dig a cave, dig a giant hole, you know. You can really just do it.
Now, and do kids like that more than playing at a regular playground? Is there anything about it that they prefer?
About with the anarchy
zone?
Yeah,
with the style of play? Do you think?
You know, there's something I feel like they feel like at home here. To me, it feels like a kid habitat. You know, there's trees and bushes and, you know, the wind in the trees, and then there's kid stuff, and it almost feels like, you know, if you, I don't know, a dreamland for a kids because of that kind of freedom. But at the same time, you know, the playground equipment calls to kids. And it's, I guess it feels like kid stuff too, with its colors and things. And I'm not all against, you know, playground equipment, because it's, you know, a lot of it's interesting and it's built strong and it's made to do what it's designed to do and it can last a long time. But it's funny, a friend got her PhD and her dissertation studied play, children's play on the Anarchy Zone versus on traditional playground equipment. Huh. And it was interesting. It was the same group of kids. It was like a summer program at a local community center. And they just watched what happened. And when the kids were at the Anarchy Zone, there were no conflicts. And the adults, who kind of are like the counselors with those kids, just felt like, oh, they just sat at the picnic tables and they felt like, we don't have to do anything. Like, and the kids are engaged. And there's just like so much to do that nobody was bored. Like, you can always do something more. Someone else is always doing something interesting, or you can join in, or you can do stuff. And they'd be here for hours and never bored and no conflicts. When we went back to the traditional playground, which was impressive and it had, you know, all sorts of great features. It happened each day that we were there. It was good for about 20 minutes.
Hmm.
And after 20 minutes, they'd done all the swinging. They'd done all the climbing. They'd done, you know, they kind of did it all. And then things would start to happen. Then there'd be some conflicts. Then there would be, the kids would be pushing the limits because they still, at the Anarchy Zone or a traditional playground, kids want to take it to the next level. They want to push it. So after that 20 minutes, they would push things, and there was a scarcity of materials, like basketballs, there's, you know, loose stuff. There's just a few of them and a lot of kids, and then there would be conflicts with the scarcity of materials. And it's interesting with that 20 minutes because that's very telling of, like, the Anarchy Zone. I've never seen a bored kid. And they can do it for hours. But, like, if you think about school recesses, they could be, like, 20-minute long, right? Oh, and, you know, I hate to even think about that. You know, I've talked to some friends in Canada. They're like, we only have 2 40-minute recesses, and that's not enough. We feel so terrible about that. And I think my son's school here, they get 20 minutes. So, in that sense, 20 minutes, I guess, does it. But what are you missing? And I also like to think about, like, playground equipment's good for physical stuff, right? You know, and like, they can play sports. But play and childhood, there's so much more than just the physical aspect. And some kids like to do monkey bars, but not all the kids. Mm-hmm. And if all you have is monkey bars, well, what about the kid who's inventive and can build stuff, or has great dramatic ideas, and, you know, can lead, and or is a good leader, or, you know, can make up stories and get people to join them? And so there's so many different types of play, and they're all really important for children. So I like the idea of designing and creating spaces for children that offer opportunities for all the different kinds of play.
I directed a play called Swallows and Amazons with from a British children's book about kids just being out in nature and being allowed to camp in this island in the Lakes District. And part of my audition for high school students was to go to the elementary playground and play. And I was assessing them with a clipboard, watching them play. And I told them before we went, I said, you know, I need to see you be inventive, you know, be able to tap that, because that's so much about what the characters do. And it was interesting because a lot of these teenagers didn't, it was gone, you know, like they couldn't get back there if they ever had it. That kind of really rich, inventive play life. And we were trying to use the playground as, you know, could they turn it into a rocket or a pirate ship or whatever? Mm-hmm. And many of them even, I think, felt silly doing that. But they were playing children in the story. So it was interesting even watching their capacity to be inventive with that. I was also thinking of my father built with a carpenter, a treehouse in their woods in Wisconsin for his grandkids, and they never used it. It was a pretty impressive treehouse, but the grandkids would always, my kids and their cousins would just be building teepees and forts on the ground with loose parts, right?
Yeah.
And they just completely neglected this expensive treehouse that it was built. It was such an indication to me that, yeah, this kind of play, children prefer the edges to the manicured parts, usually, you know? Do they, when you're putting together a new project, is my hunch accurate that safety is the biggest concern for many adults who aren't used to this idea?
That's interesting. The biggest concern, safety is a concern, you know, if it's an adventure playground like this, or the natural playgrounds that I do with childcare centers and schools and stuff, there's playground, you know, natural playground safety guidelines and stuff that you can follow. So when you're designing, I think it's maybe the hardscape, you can follow all that stuff easy enough. With this, it's a little different because kids could fall, that giant tractor tire could fall on them. You know, it's definitely riskier. But I think people now are starting to, you know, agree that risk is actually important for children. That when we make everything safe, if safety is the number one thing, well, then we should just keep kids inside, keep them in a soft room with pillows. I mean, that could be fun too, I guess. But people differentiate between a risk and a hazard. Mm. So even at the Anarchy Zone, like, it looks risky, but the adults who kind of run this space, one of their jobs is to remove hazards. And so just a quick definition, people say risk is good, hazard is bad, you could just say. But a risk is something that a child sees that could be dangerous, but they can choose to interact with it. I could fall off this. That tire could fall on me, but I'm gonna go for it or not go for it. A risk is like something that's broken or jagged or sharp or something that they don't see. That can hurt them.
Here Rusty misspoke. The second category, things they don't see that could hurt them, are hazards, not risks.
So if there's adults that are thinking about these kind of spaces, I think it's like our job to, let's remove all the hazards, all the things that could just like surprise a kid and hurt them, and then have the risky stuff out there, because it's important for kids to be able to assess risk and try things out. I mean, their job is to learn, grow, take things to the next level. That's what growth and development is. But also, I think with risk, we want them, as far as like long-term safety, health and safety, we want them to kind of form that connection with their inner guidance that we all have. But that lets them know, do I want to try this? Do I not want to try this? Is this is sketchy? Do I really want to, or do I not want to?
Do you think kids have, you said inner guidance, do you think that, do we all have, or do you develop it through a place like this and this kind of play, like that inner, like a tuning of that guidance between, like, is this risky or is this reckless? Is it a hazard?
Yeah,
I wonder if it's one of those things where you just have to do it a lot, you know, to kind of get to the point of, I was even watching this little like 3-year-old before. And yeah, there was an adult that was helping secure the giant tractor tire so it wouldn't crush him.
Yeah.
But the little boy was putting this board as a little ramp to climb up a little higher onto it. But it was only a couple feet off the ground, but it was really thin wood and it was flexing underneath him, almost breaking. And it was great watching him, because you could almost see him learning, like the material limits of this, of the object, and also his own balance and his maybe also his discernment about, like, is this something that's risky, but like I can do it, or the material will hold or not. Like, lots of stuff seemed like it was going on. I don't know. Is that something that you think develops more strongly when we practice it?
I think so. I think children need that. They need the kind of, to be exposed to this kind of stuff, to try it all out and test their limits, test the materials, you know, test how they feel about stuff, and sometimes fall, right? Sometimes have that board break. You know, we don't want anything catastrophic to happen, but All those kind of minor things, that's all learning and growing and kind of making notes, building your brain. And I think when children don't have that kind of stuff, when they're just maybe sheltered from that, maybe it's good, it's good intentions from the adults. They don't want their kids hurt. But as they grow in life, you hear stories that they have a harder time dealing with, I don't know, setbacks or knowing what their limits are, or they go wild as teenagers behind the wheel of a car, you know, just because they don't know the limits. They haven't had those kind of experiences.
Mm-hmm. I wonder as well with risk, the idea of keeping kids indoors in the padded cell, kind of the helicopter parent model says, well, you know, at least they're safe inside. Like, maybe I'm overprotective, but they're safe and I'm keeping the risks at bay. But I wonder, like, but what risks are you introducing in a situation like that? I mean, with, even you were talking about the long periods of play that they're doing on a playground like this, the issues with obesity and with chronic conditions that even children are getting now. And the way we parents lament about screen time and kids just being on there all the time. I was reading a commentary, which I had never really thought about, describing online, like, immersive video games. That's the place where they're finding adventure and imagination. Like, mm-hmm. they're flexible worlds where you can travel and do things and do kind of that imaginative play that you would maybe think that kids would do at a playground. But if they're not really given play spaces that accommodate that, or even play spaces where children are the ones running what they're doing, that it's not all just organized sports that are all dictated by adults. I don't know. It makes sense to me that kids would embrace adventure in video games mm-hmm. because they're not, even Minecraft compared to Legos. Like Legos today, have you seen Lego packages?
Sure.
Modern ones? You've got young kids.
Yep.
When I had Legos as a kid, I had a big bucket of just like loose part Legos.
Yeah.
And
me too.
Can you even buy those anymore? Because I've seen are like these very specific packages that are, it's more about following the directions and making a specific thing.
Mm-hmm. You can buy, if you go online, you can buy Legos by the pound.
Okay.
And just get a whole mishmash of stuff.
Yeah.
So you can still do that. But yeah, the kits, you build the X-Wing fighter, you build Harry Potter's castle.
Right. It just seems like Minecraft, it's ironic because like I want my kids to be engaged physically, you know, tactilely and stuff, and not on screens all the time. But their desire to build like kind of a sandbox setting of just build out a landscape, in many cases, for a lot of kids, is more possible on Minecraft than if they've got a couple of several specific kits for Legos. It just seems, I loved Legos so much, and it just seems so strange that a computer version would be more flexible or more creative. That makes me sad that would be the case, but it's like almost a parallel to this certain kinds of playgrounds to something more freewheeling like the Anarchy Zone.
I think so. It's like that flexibility. Yeah. There's just stuff, and then you use your creativity or your ideas and see what happens. And you're learning how either the Minecraft world works or the Legos, what snaps together, and then or the giant tractor tires and how things go.
I was reading, there's a book called, what's her name, Angela Holscomb, I think. I'll look it up later if that's the wrong name. She wrote Barefoot and, I'm spacing on the name.
Oh, yeah.
Now. Barefoot and Balanced.
Yeah.
Is the name.
Yep.
I'm just reading that now, and she's a physiotherapist talking about the many ways that kids are losing strength and agility and just lots of issues with like occupational therapy stuff. She's seeing a huge uptick in that. But I think a lot of what she promotes is testing your body and having lots of unstructured outdoor play that's messy and that's not, you know, directed by adults all the time.
Yeah. If you think about the play that's going on here, you know, she talks a lot about movement. And movement is like the answer to so many things. And so when kids are building here with the tractor tires, they're lifting and they're pushing and they're, you know, and they're getting other people to help, or they're carrying things together, big boards, or they're trying to climb in the tree or get the tire up in the tree. So it's all this physical stuff, which is awesome, as well as the creative stuff. My sons do a little bit of Minecraft. I keep it in check, but it's amazing to see what they do. But I do this impression of them. And basically, physically, they're just like hunched over, staring, pushing with their fingers, drool coming out of the side of their mouth. But it's brain stuff, though. Like, so their imagination's going, and they're still learning and thinking and all that stuff the way that you would in the Anarchy Zone, but you don't have the physical in there.
Yeah. When my kids were younger, I always, one of the things I really wanted for their screen time was trying to promote or encourage, be a creator and not a consumer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, rather than just watching like fail videos endlessly, maybe, you know, doing things where you're composing music or you're learning how to play an instrument or something or build a thing. Like YouTube can be amazing for just learning how to do stuff.
Sure.
So I wanted to, I do feel like I need to get back to safety though. So you must have studied this already. Like is it more dangerous, but that's okay? Or is the risk factor in terms of kids actually getting hurt, like, I don't know, where does that all land from what you know about
it? Yeah, it's interesting. There have been studies about, so there was this, I talked about the study about the kind of play that happens on the Anarchy Zone or Adventure Playground versus traditional playground. There's been studies about injuries and safety on the two different styles of playgrounds. And they found that there are less injuries on Adventure Playground, Anarchy style playgrounds, than the rubber surfaced, you know, metal upright kind of things. And some people say because that children have to be more focused when you have a big tractor tire or a big plastic tunnel that you're rolling around, like you have to be on the ball. You have to be on your toes. You have to be watching what you're doing. So you kind of stay inherently safer. Or if you're doing really risky things and there isn't the ground surface on there. Whereas with like traditional playground equipment, we just assume it's safe and that rubber surface is going to protect me no matter what I do, you know, and that kids then end up pushing the limits because they want to. They want to be creative. They want to use it in different ways. So they end up, like, using it in ways that they weren't designed for, or that safety surface isn't rated for a fall from the top of the, you know, the roof.
The top of the slide, yeah. Or the top of the swing set.
Yeah.
Is where I always went.
Yeah, right?
I got bored with the swinging.
Yeah, but that was shimmy way up higher. There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then that's where kids break their arms and legs and all that kind of stuff. There might be more bumps and bruises and scratches on the Anarchy Zone style playground. But the things that we really don't want, the big bone breaks or the head injuries, they happen on the traditional playground equipment. Mm.
Yeah, that little boy that I was watching with the wood, he was trying to lift. He did lift it, not just trying. He lifted a log, you know, and he was grasping it around the middle with his arms and... He had, I think he had socks on, but no shoes. But he was, as a parent, I was worried, like, it was going to land on his foot and bruise his toes or...
Yep.
Or that he might get a splinter or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's not a traumatic head injury or something from a giant fall.
Yeah.
Do most of these play spaces, are they staffed with adults who are moderating it or managing it or... Or are they more like regular parks?
So I would say that this Anarchy Zone is inspired by these adventure playgrounds that kind of came out of Europe and Japan after World War II, when after the horrible bombings and stuff in neighborhoods, kids would come out, the healing properties of play, and they would build with the broken bricks and boards and, you know, the stuff that was suddenly their world. But there was really rich play. Adults witnessed this, and they thought this is really incredible. And so they kind of, through a process, they ended up cleaning up some of these bomb sites, but then providing them for children with the loose materials. And in doing so, they also developed this whole profession called playwork that is not to lead the adults. It's an adult, a trained adult on site that is supporting the play. They're not leading the play. They're not, like, leading games or telling the kids what to do. They're just around the outside edges, stepping in when they need to, or doing heavy lifting, or, you know, helping kids out, or being invited into the play by kids. But it's this, and it's been going all this time in Europe, really big play work. And you can get trained in it. You can get degrees in it. You can get your master's. You can get a PhD in it. And so that is... Most of the adventure playgrounds, especially the European ones, have trained play workers there in all the hours that they're open. This one's a little different, where it's they have play workers at different times for different events, and then but at the same time, it's open to the public. So it's a little bit different. And so it's kind of like a play at your own risk a little bit. But the whole play work profession is really picking up steam now in North America. And so, yes, for adventure playgrounds, but also for preschools, like how preschool teachers who believe in play and support play, but there's a whole different kind of mindset with the play worker who's, we know that play is learning and all that kind of growth and development, but they're just like, they don't really care about that. They know it's there, but they support the play and what they can do to help. You know, what kind of interventions and have the least amount of interventions, adult interventions, as possible. Just basically let the kids play.
So that all started, it really started with them watching the healing play around the rubble and things after the war.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that part at all. I knew that it came, that it was focused more in Europe and Japan.
Yeah, the first one, the official first one was in Denmark during the Nazi occupation, and that kids were just building with the stuff. Now, that was, it was like a landscape architect that kind of first saw the potential of these kind of junk playgrounds. That's what they called them at first, junk playgrounds. And he would see that he designed these beautiful play structures and parks and things, but the kids just love playing on like the construction site beforehand or the big pile of dirt or, you know, that kind of stuff. So he was like, well, how can we create almost like the kind of play that kids in the country have, how can we, around barns and farms and all that kind of stuff and animals, how can we do that in the city? And then, you know, they're still going strong in Denmark and Germany and Sweden, UK.
So when you, how long has Anarchy Zone been here?
Started in 2012.
Okay. Yep. Now, was the process of getting it approved difficult? One thing that I keep thinking about is like the liability fears that are so, I don't know, that seem pretty daunting in American culture.
Yeah.
Or that would have slowed this process down, at least in a lot of places. Did it slow it down here? Was it hard to get it approved? Is Ithaca just like kind of an anomaly in a cool place that allowed it more?
Ithaca, this is up Ithaca's alley for sure. It was a good place to do it. But it did not slow things down. And we had to go through all the same steps of talking to insurance, talking to the city, talking to, you know, board of directors and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's funny because, you know, in America we like to say, oh, we can't do that. Oh, they could do it in Europe, but we can't do it here. Or, yeah, the liability, or they'll just, you know, it's a litigious society and all that kind of stuff. But to me, that makes me feel like we need to do it even more. Like we really need to do it. And so part of like starting it here was like, let's show that you can do it. Let's talk to the insurance. And so one thing that the city says, so this is all on parkland. As far as insurance goes, that they insure all the parks in Ithaca. They insure the public pool in Ithaca. They insure the parks that are on the lake and on the waterfront and all this kind of stuff. So they kind of just looked at this like, all right, so there's tires and loose stuff. They didn't think anything, you know, no big deal. Oh, okay. And I mean, I was sweating going into that meeting, and same with the board of directors and stuff. But we started small. You know, I think that's the most important thing with any of this kind of stuff. Like, you know, we see these great things. The Anarchy Zone's been going almost 10 years. So there's a lot going on here. But it started basically flat space. And our first day was just like cardboard boxes, a big pile of wood chips, and, you know, maybe the cardboard tubes that came in carpet stores. So for anybody, I think have the dream big, but start small and start what's manageable. And while a lot of the adventure playgrounds have like boards and nails and hammers and saws, here they don't really get into that too much. And in the beginning, we were wondering, is an adventure playground, you have to have that? And we kind of felt like, well, the adventure playground really is the concept, the idea, the freedom for children. And if it goes in that direction eventually, sure, but maybe not. And so you can go, you know, I think before you get into like the real things that are really sharp and dangerous, just start to try the ideas out and see how it goes.
Was it on your website or maybe a video you did, or maybe I read it somewhere else? There was these like pop-up versions. You mentioned kind of like cardboard and stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like I read about people just doing this like pop-up play spaces in a park.
That's right. That's
where
right.
It was just like a lot of duct tape and cardboard and, I don't know, cardboard tubing or something like that. I mean, stuff that just really literally went up for a day and then they built stuff out of it and made things. And then, which seems like a really nice, like low point of entry that wouldn't be hard to do logistically or get people on board with. Even as just a launching pad or a way to test out the idea without a ton of investment, maybe.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the adventure playgrounds that have started in North America, kind of in these 10 years, start off that way of like interested parents, interested teachers are like, let's try this thing and we'll just try it in some parks and we'll have a play day along with like a street festival that's going on, or we'll do it, you know, after school, or we'll take over this one corner of a park. And yeah, you're just testing the ideas out and be like, oh, okay. And it's amazing. Like, you put out cardboard and some hula hoops and balls and traffic cones and some straw bales, and you say yes to kids, and they go for it. And I've been to play conferences, and you see the same thing. It's all around the world. You put that stuff out there, and kids can't help but be creative and do interesting, fun, weird things with it.
I bet you see them just, like, flock over from the regular playground to come to the other space, if they're inside of each other or next to each other or something. So we're here at the children's garden, and there's kind of a busy road along. Is that a river or an inlet lake?
Yeah.
Is this the town proper on the other side?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is not really like right in the middle of town.
That's
right.
Is
this a place where kids can get to by themselves or not so easily? Or
not as much. And that's a little different too than a lot of the kind of the traditional. Especially the European adventure playgrounds. I think the most successful are where it's in a neighborhood, and that's where all the kids go after school, and that's their hangout, and then they have the relationship with the play workers, and yeah. So this is a little bit removed, a little bit more of a destination. But they also have programs where they're having vans that bring kids after school here and different kinds of programs. And then they're working to get the kids that live in that neighborhood on the hill behind us there to kind of come down or feel free and welcome to come mm-hmm. down here too. And thinking a lot about play equity issues and who does come here or who feels comfortable here and how we can have everybody be able to come here. But then there's the next step of doing now the more the pop-up, the more temporary kinds of things. And I've been involved a little bit in that in some of the parks where we're having trained play workers and a storage shed and the junk. And they just go to know that like 3 days a week, this time after school, there'll be an adult there and this stuff and other kids. And actually, they did it kind of coming, you know, in the thick of COVID. At one point, I can't remember which time of year it was. Maybe it was when the school year started last year. I can't remember. But still, everybody was, you know, still pretty quarantined and separated. But following all the, like, the health and safety county guidelines and everything, we did these play days. And it was, like, one of the most beautiful things I've seen, where it was, like, again, that healing power of play. And, like, kids together. You know, everyone's masked up. They all washed hands. We all answered the questions before playing that day. But it was just to see kids, like, together again and doing things and just messing around and like being normal. It was like one of these things that suddenly it just felt normal again, you know?
I bet that also, if there were, that'd be a nice way for parents who might be reluctant or didn't know about this place ground to, I don't know, give them a little bit of a taste of it. Kind of if that's a hurdle that people would feel as well, if they wanted to build one of these in their town, just getting a comfort level among parents who might be nervous about that. Do parents tend to like be nervous and a little protective when they do come at first, or do people that come here get it already and like you just think that they let their kids go? And
you see a mix. Yeah, I think it's all on a spectrum. And so you'll see some parents that just sit on the side on the picnic table there on the edge and let their kids just go for it. There's others that are right in there playing with the kids, and then there's some that are nervous and like you know, spotting them every step of the way. But you know, there's a lot of talk with the play workers that another one of their jobs is to sometimes like bring the parents, like say, hey, I could use some help over here at the shed, could you help me lift this stuff? Or you know, kind of created some of a little bit more freedom for the kids. But I will say that a couple things, like I was at a garage sale and I heard some moms talking, saying, oh, you have to come to our backyard. We built an anarchy zone.
Nice.
And so, like, people are getting that idea. I've seen that with preschools that do a little bit more of this kind of stuff, where at first the parents might be nervous, but then they see all the stuff that their kids are doing and freedom and at the preschool outside, and then they feel a little more comfortable, like, oh, I could try that at home myself. And
I think that the parents spotting the kid in the park, in the playground, maybe that's the same thing for them with risk and hazard. You know, maybe it's their learning curve as well of like, oh, I thought this was a hazard, so I needed to help.
Yeah.
But now I see that it's just a little bit of a risk. It's not, you know, maybe parents too just need that time to learn to assess that kind of and change their perception of what is real, what their child is capable of.
Yeah.
And what they're not.
Yeah.
Are you working on, so we'll wrap up. We've been going, talking for a long time. I've loved this
great
conversation.
I
so
know,
much.
Me too.
Thank you. Thank you. What are you working on now?
Well, I actually am really excited. A long-term project is getting completed in construction. Actually, it's this autism nature trail at Letchworth State Park in New York State, Western New York. And worked on a design team with that, and experts of folks working with people on the autism spectrum, and it's like a 1 mile trail in the woods that's welcoming all people of all abilities, and it's a lot of sensory experiences and chill out areas and music areas, reflection points and everything. So yeah, we're kind of getting excited to see that come to completion.
How soon will that launch?
Beginning of October here, so the next couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah,
just before it gets cold.
Kick it off. Yeah, that's right.
Hey, thanks so much for this conversation.
Thank
I've
you.
Really, really enjoyed it, Russ.
Me too. Thanks so much.
I want to thank Rusty Keeler for our conversation. It was great getting to meet him and to visit the Anarchy Zone. I encourage you to check out his website, rustykeeler.com. That is RustyKeeler.com. You can also check out his YouTube channel, where you can tour his backyard and watch some of the discussions and trainings he's done. And if you really want to geek out on this subject, I highly recommend his book, Adventures in Risky Play, What is Your Yes? This is an oversized book filled with beautiful photos and inspiration of this whole world of fully engaged play. Thanks so much for joining me for episode 1 of the Envisioning Education podcast. A conversation about adventure playgrounds may seem to be a strange launching pad, removed from the unschooling and self-directed learning centers, but I actually think it's a great place to start. Places like the Anarchy Zone encourage children's creativity and independence and personal agency. More and more, most kids today have very little room in their lives for unstructured play that isn't dictated and directed by parents and nannies and coaches and teachers. Almost all of us who were raised in earlier decades lament that today's kids aren't able to play the way we did. Out the door early and told to come home when the streetlights came on. But what are we doing to give them that childhood, or a piece of it? While it isn't our job to direct how they play, it is our responsibility to do what we can to create space in their lives, and spaces where they can play freely. Rusty often uses what I think is a helpful slogan, dream big, start small. As I dream of helping to build wonderful places like the Anarchy Zone in every neighborhood in Chicago, the next part is really the key, isn't it? What small step can I do now to get that movement started? I'm thinking about those pop-up adventure playgrounds. Anyone want to talk about how we could host one of those in your neighborhood park? Thanks for joining me today.